Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Friday, September 23rd. I'm June Brasso with Michael Best. Police cannot search an unattended smartphone with no passcode. And a federal judge slams Facebook for not taking seriously lawsuits accusing it of facilitating terrorism. Michael, imagine this scenario. A man leaves his smartphone, which is not protected with a passcode, behind in someone's apartment. Police find incriminating evidence on it. Did he lose his expectation of privacy in the phone? The Arizona Supreme Court ruled that he did not and threw out the evidence that police found on the phone.
With us today to talk about this decision is Lance Rogers, a legal editor for Bloomberg BNA. Lance, we're very happy to have you here today. Why don't you start by telling us exactly what the Arizona Supreme Court ruled in this case?
Sure. You guys noted, they said a man didn't lose his expectation of privacy in the contents of a smartphone just because he failed to protect it with a passcode and left it unattended in a room full of police officers and paramedics.
Tell us what they based that on.
They based that on a Supreme Court decision a couple years ago. You may remember Riley versus California, which held that arresting officers have to get a warrant to search the mobile phones of arrestees because mobile phones contain so much personal information, the court said. The old search incident to arrest doctrine, which allows police to go through an arrestee's effects for safety and security reasons, doesn't give police the right to scour the data on a smartphone, the court said. Phones aren't like a wallet or a purse. I think the court even said the sum of an individual's private life can be reconstructed just by going through the cell phone, whereas you wouldn't be able to do that to that great detail even if you searched every piece of paper in that person's house. So cell phones are unique.
But if this was a situation where, as I understand it, he was fleeing from the scene when the police, or he ran from the scene when the police were coming, and if he had, say, left a notebook there with a lot of information in it, they wouldn't have had to get a warrant to look through that, would they have?
No, they wouldn't have. That's a good question. We'll back up the facts a little bit here. This is a case of Robin Peoples. He's not a very sympathetic defendant who was charged with necrophilia after police found a video he made of himself having sex with his unresponsive girlfriend. The woman's daughter found her mother and apparently called 911. And while he was in the bathroom, and then he left his smartphone behind and ran from the apartment to direct paramedics to the apartment and then went upstairs to a friend's apartment, according to the court, to seek solace. And the police found the phone and assumed it belonged to the victim and started going through it to find maybe her doctor to see what medication she was on. But instead, they came across a still image of a paused video and they decided to play it. So I guess what the court was saying is that the cops crossed the line when they started viewing the video. And it's a very interesting decision because they don't say in the decision what they would have done if this phone actually had belonged to the victim.
It seemed to me as if the police did everything you would expect. They find a phone. There's no one's name on it. It's not password protected. They're looking for information, and they see a video, and they play it. It seems as if it's more akin to something being in plain view almost. They had no idea that it was this man's, because does this opinion basically say that cell phones are just per se protected?
I would say that the bottom line to come out of this is that police should usually get a warrant before mining the information on a cell phone. Also that I should probably start taking advantage of the passcode protect system, or at least that's what my kids tell me.
But Lance, doesn't it in effect mean that cell phones really do now explicitly, if this case gets followed in other places, have more protection than almost any other object that somebody might leave out in plain view somewhere?
That's exactly right. I think that the court would say, and I might be putting words in their mouth here, that the police couldn't go over to the computer on the desk and start opening up files saying that they were looking for information to help them find the woman's doctor to find out what medication she might have been on.
Are there any cases coming up before the Supreme Court where this is going to be examined more? Because I wonder if they're going a little bit further than the court intended.
I don't know if they're going further than the court intended, and the court hasn't accepted review of any cases to sort of flesh out the Riley decision. I think that your point about this being in plain view and this being an investigation of a death are really compelling ones.
A federal judge in Brooklyn has unfriended Facebook and the law firm representing it. In fact, Judge Nicholas Garofis slammed Facebook, saying the social media giant might not be doing enough to stop terrorists from using its platform. Garofis is overseeing two lawsuits in which more than 20,000 victims of attacks and their families accuse Facebook of helping groups in the Middle East, such as Hamas. He was livid that the law firm representing Facebook, Kirkland & Ellis, sent a first-year associate to the hearing, calling it outrageous, irresponsible, and insulting, and accusing the firm of not taking seriously lawsuits with implications of international terrorism and the murder of innocent people. The judge ordered Kirkland and Ellis to send a senior lawyer to the next hearing on September 28th because he wants to talk to someone who talks to senior management at Facebook. Facebook said its community standards made clear that there is no place on Facebook for groups that engage in terrorist activity or content that expresses support for it, and we take our swift action to remove this content when it's reported to us. Our guests are Andrea Matwishan, a professor at Northeastern University Law School, and Eric Goldman, a professor and co-director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University Law School. Andrea, Garofis admitted that federal judges have limited ability to address terrorism and don't usually get involved until someone is charged with a crime. So tell us more about these civil cases.
So in this case, we have the plaintiffs who are the family members and other interested parties who have been directly touched by acts of terrorism. And so it is entirely understandable that they would wish to seek some legal redress for the harms that they have suffered as a consequence of these terrorist acts. The question that these cases present and that the judge highlighted is whether these particular cases and this particular form of litigation, naming Facebook and in other cases, social media platforms such as Twitter and others, whether the correct avenue for obtaining justice and redress for these particular plaintiffs is through finding these companies liable for the use of the alleged use of some of these terrorist groups of these platforms in connection with planning or executing or coordinating these activities. And so Eric will notably speak to Section 230 of the CDA, but in general, the approach, as the judge pointed out, is one that gives deference to services such as these as mere places of exchanging ideas without editorial supervision.
Yes, Eric, what is the approach that the American law takes in cases like this?
Well, we don't have a lot of cases involving internet companies in general or social media sites in particular being liable for their use by terrorist organizations. So we have to start looking at general principles and looking at analogies in order to figure out what might happen. But the main legal issues are going to revolve around both the First Amendment and the right of both individuals and social media sites to have free speech, as well as a particular law that Congress enacted in 1996. Which we're going to call Section 230 for our purposes here, that basically says websites aren't liable for third-party content. And so one of the core dilemmas in the lawsuits is, are these lawsuits trying to hold the social media sites liable for third-party, in this case, the terrorist organization's content? If so, that runs directly into a different policy goal that Congress has articulated.
Andrea, a California judge ruled that U.S. law protects Twitter from being treated as a publisher of any information provided by another content provider. Are there any cases, are there any other cases where a judge has ruled?
So an analogy might be imperfect, but yet useful here. In other areas of law where we have concerns of inappropriate or illegal content being posted, for example, with respect to, say, copyright infringement, though admittedly intellectual property law is not on the same level as terrorist activity. But there we adopt a notice and takedown approach. So the nuance that I think some of these judges are grappling with is the question of whether there was actual notice provided to these companies and the companies knowing that particular content or particular users were engaging in this activity failed to do something, or whether the companies are trying to manage millions or even billions of accounts and did not have particularized notice that a particular account was engaging in acts that were violative of the terms of use and amounted to the level of potentially furthering terrorism.
Well, Eric, it sounds like Facebook probably has a pretty good legal defense on this case. Do you think that that might be why they would only send a junior attorney to court to do a court hearing?
Judge's remarks were wholly out of bounds and really, I think, exposed some of the judge's biases about what it expects Facebook to be doing. First of all, in many judges' chambers, judges encourage law firms to send junior attorneys as part of getting them integrated into the practice. Otherwise, we have a small number of litigators who get most of the experience. And second of all, it may very well be that the young attorney was, in fact, the best person to handle this particular matter. So I don't know what the judge wanted. The judge wanted a phalanx of gray-haired lawyers all there charging $2,000 an hour. But for the judge to call out Facebook for sending who it thought was its appropriate representative is, I think, completely inappropriate.
Andrea, on the other side of that, Kirkland & Ellis, a firm with more than 150 partners, sent an attorney who's been out of law school for 1 year to this conference with a federal judge in the Eastern District for what's been estimated to be a $1 billion lawsuit. And the excuse was that the partner was called away to Texas. Is there a certain inappropriateness in sending someone who's been out of law? I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was out of law school in a law firm for a year, I didn't know much of anything about what to do in addressing a federal court judge.
Well, this, as Eric pointed out, this is a relatively early stage in the process of the case, and there is, of course, a premium on bringing lawyers along and helping them learn. Now, that said, I think what the judge was reacting to was the seriousness of the set of issues that this case implicates. And for this judge, it came off as a bit tone deaf on the part of Kirkland to send an associate so junior. And for this judge, it signaled a perhaps lack of respect for the plaintiff and his courtroom. From Kirkland & Ellis' standpoint, they were probably keeping costs down for the client. And having practiced in the large firm, that's the approach. And as Eric pointed out, the law is relatively clear here, and there's a benefit to bringing along lawyers. But in this case, it's the presentation of taking the matters that we're struggling with as a society in a serious way with the appropriate gravitas both for the courtroom and the social issues that are implicated.
Our thanks to Andrea Matuition, a professor at Northeastern University Law School, and Eric Goldman, a law professor at Santa Clara Law School and co-director of its high-tech law institute. Now, June, let's take a look at the top story on BloombergLaw.com.
President Barack Obama has vetoed a bill that would have allowed the families of 9/11 victims to sue the government of Saudi Arabia. This move sets Obama up for a possible first veto override by Congress because both chambers passed the bill by voice vote. The House sent the bill appeal to Obama just before the 15th anniversary of the attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people in New York, Washington, and September. Obama's concern is that the bill would upset longstanding international principles regarding sovereign immunity. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back on Monday and hope you will be as well. Thanks to our technical director, Mark Seniscalchi, and our producer, David Sutcherman. The Bay State Business Hour is next for our Boston audience. With All Due Respect is next for our listeners in Washington, D.C., and Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York and San Francisco. I'm June Grosso with Michael Best. Have a great weekend. This is Bloomberg.
Listen to Bloomberg Law weekdays at 4:30 p.m. Eastern in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Washington on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2 Baltimore, in Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2, in San Francisco on 960 AM and 103.7 FM HD2, and Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2016 Bloomberg LP.